I had a request to review the sphere.
Yes. Everyone got it. See if I can remember it.
I guess our question too, we were talking on break, is it representative of the world in any way, or it's just a geometric figure to represent a relationship of the Trinity? That's what we're confused
about. And each sphere, the miracle, you know, in their mind, the miracle of the world is that God's presence can be seen in the geometric relations in each sphere.
Each sphere. Is there
planet,
a sphere in this room?
A sphere.
Well, that
picture
was supposed to be
the cosmos.
Yeah, and that's
why we put it in your eye. We have a sphere in our eye.
A sphere in our eye.
Okay.
Your head's a sphere.
It's
on your body.
Okay, so it's got this
but three-dimensional, I think.
Kind of a global approach to with God.
And of course, where he's working with it is planets, sun, earth. Mm-hmm. He I don't know if he's saying it. I mean, I think he said it because he believed it. I don't think he was just being political. But the implication is, look, church, the world is sacred. And it's not evil, and my work is not a heresy, because we can see in the shape of the universe God himself.
So he was saying spirit and matter.
In a way, he was, yeah. The form of matter showed the spirit.
Not that God was actually in the matter, but
no,
that it represented God.
That it represented God, yeah.
That was God's handiwork.
It was a sign of God's handiwork. God created the world, putting himself in it in the analogy of form.
So it was the Genesis story, really. The beginning of Genesis that he was talking about, where God created the world.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so he was saying to the, Bishop C, there's nothing wrong with what we're doing. I don't think he was saying it politically. I think he really believed it. I think it's what he felt was why he was doing this work, that his work was a religious service. Because by investigating the mathematics of the universe, we became closer to a knowledge of God. Because God created the clockwork that makes the universe tick. I believe he really would say he was on a religious. His science was a form of worship. In fact, I think he wanted to be a preacher at one point, and then did this instead. And the only problem with it is that it leaves no room for irregularity. That's what we're going to be making out of it. And the other thing is there at the bottom of 27, that prior to this time, from Greece, it was entertained that the world had a soul. And the soul is what moved things. There was a soul which permeated. The world might be bad, but the soul that permeated it and moved it wasn't. Well, of course, that all got thrown out. So the regularity of the universe becomes the presence of God, and that's what moves things. And this Greek idea of the soul is nonsense because it can't be measured. Measurable things are divine because they're regular. There he quotes Kepler. My aim is to show that the heavenly machine, you see, the universe becomes a machine, a predictable machine, is not a kind of divine live being, but a kind of clockwork. And he who believes that the clock has a soul attributes the maker's glory to the Word. So he's not seeing the glory of God in the soul which moves things, but in the mechanism of movement which is God. Insofar as nearly all manifold motions are caused by a most simple magnetic and material force, just as all motions of the clock are caused by a simple weight.
Now, what's the distinction you're making there? But
that the soul as moving the world is not emphasized, but the regularity of the movements of the world like a machine is the evidence for God. And because we can investigate the regularity, we are investigating God. You can't investigate the regularity of a vapor. That is degenerate theology, he says.
So this isn't really yet a split. It just sets up the groundwork to create the split that comes later.
Yeah, see, it's on this basis, then, that what is real is what's regular, and the soul gets excluded. And the soul is what we're saying is behind synchronicity. So a double whammy is given to any phenomena which break the regularity of events.
But you did say, didn't you, that soul is a mechanism?
No, soul is, soul is not the the object worthy of inquiry because it can't be regularly determined.
So the mechanism is still God, then?
Mechanism is God. A God who, like a weight on a string, sets the universe in motion. And he has set it in motion, and its motion is an indication, the regularity of its motion is an indication of he who set it in motion.
But it isn't him. Isn't that an important distinction to make, that they're not saying this is God?
No, it's evidence.
This is evidence of the handiwork of a God that exists out there, because eventually God just gets totally taken out of the picture.
Right.
So he's,
in a way, he is getting removed one step at a time.
Right. Now they're saying that because Frank begins to name this as something different that makes all this happen.
Yeah, right.
So it's not God in matter. It's God having created this.
From afar.
From afar, right.
Right.
But separate from.
But separate from.
Very orderly and predictable.
Orderly and predictable.
And the church would accept that, I would think, that God created things.
Well, they did, you know, they did and they didn't, until you stepped on the wrong person's toes. I mean, it was just like here. You know, one bureaucrat would accept what you said and another wouldn't, and he just happened to piss off the wrong bureaucrat who would interpret it differently. I think for a while this was acceptable theology. But then somebody got paranoid. And then somebody set a process in motion.
For Kepler, the soul had nothing to do with God. I mean, where did the soul fit in with?
Now we're talking about the soul of the world.
Okay.
Not, I don't think this would apply to the soul of an individual. But the soul of the world.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there is that kind of soul then.
Yeah, there still can be an individual soul, but you see, when we talk about a synchronicity, we're talking about an intelligence in the world, in the material world, and the closest we come to a previous description of that phenomenon, Jung felt, was the pre-scientific, the medieval concept of the soul of the world, anima mundi.
So, not in individuals.
Boy, you got me here, Karin. I'm guessing they would say that the soul of the individual is maybe a piece of the soul of the world. But as far as they were concerned, no, the world itself had a soul. There was a soul in all things.
But Kepler said no.
Kepler said, I don't know whether he says no, but he certainly says it's irrelevant.
Okay.
And what good is it? Because since God's handiwork is discernible by the regularity of events, what good is it? If you want to know God, you don't worry about that. You worry about the laws of motion.
So your statement was that he said soul is not worthy of investigation because it's not regular?
It's not regular. Well, it can't be regularly manifested. Yeah. Or observed. See, he thought the mathematical regularity of his laws proved the existence of God. Who else could have thought up of such regularity and predictability?
Sounds like he told you to
lie. I still don't understand intelligent design. But, it could be that that is one of these things which on a certain level is true. But you've got to find out on what level. Now, where we're I'm just trying to do two things here, give you all these facts, and then try not to get you drowning in them and forget why we're doing it. We're going to be seeing in Pali's dreams going back to this world soul, which as a literal phenomenon we can't substantiate, but yet as a descriptor of certain aspects of our experience we also cannot get rid of. And we don't know what new model of the world is going to be able to deal with this, but that's the next challenge, to go back to these medieval concepts and not take them literally, but show their truth symbolically. Because that's exactly what we come to in inner work. Anyone who's done inner work sooner or later has to come to the face with the fact that the world is not dead. The material world is an active presence in their life. Yeah.
Gary, is it fair to say, I mean, you know, in the Hellenic period, during that period, the world was animated by the gods and goddesses.
Yeah.
They believed, you know,
right.
We would talk about Poseidon and all these
right.
energies, that was the energy of the ocean.
Right.
And then as Christianity took its foothold,
yeah.
that whole idea of the world being animated by those divine spirits, of the
people, right.
which the Greeks never really thought were gods, they experienced them as energies that they participated
right.
in.
Right.
And they understood their foibles and their unpredictabilities
right.
and whatever, but then as Christianity came along and had to separate out all of those ideas of that divinity, then they just sort of named it this overall mm-hmm. animating force that they call soul.
Yeah.
They split it off from these ideas because, you know, I keep thinking about Dante. He still talked about the planets as being Mercury and,
mm-hmm.
and talked about Athena and had these god and goddess images in them.
Yeah.
But Christianity was working to split those out.
Yeah.
So would have called it a world soul, and now he's even taking us a step from that
right.
idea that there's any of that animation.
Right.
And what I see us doing today already is trying to bring some of that
yeah.
back in, because we understand.
You're going to see that in his dreams all the time.
So does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
That's how it would have.
Absolutely. It's like the vitality of the gods became the pablum of the world soul.
Right, exactly.
And,
all got right
and now we got rid of the world soul.
The way of looking at
yeah.
it, and that all got dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating.
And Pali is realizing, and I think he really did understand, and we will see this as we go along, he really did understand that there was a next step in science, and the next step in science was going back to what it had rejected and finding its truth on a different level and creating a worldview that could honor that. And that was the prescription for his own personal development. And I think he knew that he was living through in his own development what science would need to live through. As a worldview evolving. We'll see where he succeeds and where he falls down. Try to give you the practical dimensions then, so you don't just get lost in all the theory. See, the blonde will be the acceptance of that truth in science. He can accept that in science as a light concept. But the darker representation, the Persian, that's about his own sexuality. And there he doesn't like that so much. So he's going to get this message, the same message, on a couple of different levels from different figures. And some he will accept, and some he will not.
isn't the clergyman wants to get into the institute, though, so that's not sexuality.
Well, it's not, let me say, it's not only sexual, but the Persian, all of these figures represent the same thing, with differing emphasis. And I think the Persian wanting to get into the institute on a scientific level would be Pauli's recognition of how science must evolve by including this new factor. But also, it was his recognition that he wasn't separate from that change. Where you will find him talking, and he's a big talker, you will hear him talking about this, theoretically about science, and when he does that, when he forgets about himself, then he dreams of the blonde. And then pretty soon, these figures are going to blend into a unified figure called the stranger. At that point, he's beginning to realize, I have to include myself in these theoretical discussions.
So is the blonde a male or female?
A male.
It's a male.
Yeah, these are all men. We'll get women later, but they first approach as men. Well, we got the dark woman, didn't we? We had her. See, that's this recognition on the level of his love life. And really, they are not two separate things, but he's going to try to keep them separate.
Could you think of these various figures as all representatives of the creative principle? Whatever that animating creative force.
Yes, I think you could.
And so because that makes it both internal and external, yeah. And it makes it sexual, I mean, it comes in all these various forms.
Yeah.
So whatever that creative dynamism in him that's longing to be born, it was both without and within,
yeah.
And showed up in these various lights and shadow ways.
Absolutely. I would, say this way, Nancy, that really what we're looking at, creativity, I'll give you a sentence I heard in a dream once. Creativity is the spiritual counterpart of the evolutionary instinct. What I understood that to mean is that we are not just evolving physiologically, we are evolving spiritually. And the creativity, in its largest sense, in the collective unconscious, is that push to move us mentally to keep up with the physical. And yes, that's what we're seeing here. So deep creativity evolves the species.
What I hear is participation, the sense of participation that's going on between the collective and the individual. Not just one without the other, it's not separate. You talked about evolution, and you talked about... what was your statement again,
Ben? Creativity is the spiritual counterpart of the evolutionary instinct.
Right. It's just feels
participatory. And it works through the individual. Maybe that's what you're driving at.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And, just a little bit of a tangent, but I... Another reason why I feel this is important, as I mentioned with that work on Toynbee, Toynbee's understanding of creative individuals is they take up within themselves their personal version of the problem which is bugging the society. And they solve it. And in solving it, they pave the way for the development of the society. I think that's what's going on with Pauli. So that he's working both on himself and his society at the same time. And why I think this is another reason why I think this work is so important. You get all the time in Jungian psychology, oh, it's an inner process. It is not an inner process. It's a process with an inner dimension and an outer dimension. And here you can see it.
Does it ever happen in the reverse, too, where they take up that issue but they only work it in the outer world and not in the inner world?
I think that's what always happens.
Yeah, I do, too.
And that's why our world's such a mess. I got into this somewhat because of being disappointed in my own generation. I was visiting one of my most radical SDS friends. The guy makes ads for SUVs. What happened? And his son hates him. When you only address the thing on the outside, you become the thing you're fighting. That's the tragedy of change. But, and I think what Jung has given us is really the first glimpse of a way to achieve social change, which doesn't end up becoming the very thing you fight. I remember, you remember Norman O. Brown? Anybody ever read him? Love's Body? He was one of the big philosophers of the 60s. He taught in Santa Cruz, where I lived for a while. And I went to one of his classes I got permission to attend. He was a really very interesting guy. And one of the kids went off on him saying, you know, you were this radical, and now you're writing these books and so on, and you don't seem to have your political edge anymore. And he stopped. He said to the kid, did you hear about the boy who hated his father so much he became just like him? That's what we're dealing with, I think. When you attack an outer problem without doing the inner work that is your parallel to it, then you become the very thing that you are fighting.
Where did your quote come from? Do you know?
That was from the self.
Okay.
I came in a dream.
It came from your dream?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I would have never thought of that. And maybe nobody else either. I don't know.
Creativity
is the spiritual counterpart of the evolutionary instinct.
And then the next one was creative focus.
Oh, that was Norman O. Brown. Did you hear about the... That's the one you mean? Did you hear about the boy who hated his father so much he became just like him?
No, he just said creative folks think of the problem of society and more
things. Oh, that's Toynbee.
Toynbee.
That's Toynbee.
Arnold, right?
Arnold Toynbee, yeah. Yeah, he looked at the relationship between societal development and the creative individuals. Well, I think, I don't know if he calls them, Mettinger calls them the creative minority.
Did he actually say creative folks take the problem of society and work it out on the inner area?
He and Jung, it's like you're reading an extrovert's and an introvert's view on life.
Okay, did he say inner or did he say outer?
He makes it very clear he's talking about the relationship between the two.
Okay.
Oh, very clear.
Did say inner?
Yes.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, he and Jung were fond of each other's work.
Okay,
they came at the same thing from a study of civilizations, of course Jung from study of the inner world, but that the inner and the outer world are not separate. Definitely says that. If you want to read it, he's got a 13-volume thing, which I wouldn't recommend. But there is a one-volume picture, condensation.
Abridgment,
thank you. It's called A Study of History. And it's only published in England, but you could probably get it on Amazon. And it's the one with pictures. There was a two-volume abridgment, which actually he did. And he even said that the one-volume abridgment is better than the one he did. So he recommended that above his own abridgment. It's very
that are you asked for?
Oh, believe me. I mean, he analyzes, I think, 18 civilizations. I mean, detail by detail, to see what makes a civilization grow and what makes a civilization disintegrate. This was his interest, and because he's responding to Spengler, who was saying the West is falling apart, the decline of the West. Oswald Spengler wrote a book in the 19th century called The Decline of the West. And he said the West is finished. And Tommy said, let's have a closer look. And he took 18 civilizations throughout history, analyzed them piece by piece. What was common to those civilizations that were growing and what was common to those civilizations that were collapsing? His conclusion, there are not external factors. There is not... economic issues. It's whether the creative voice can be heard in that civilization. And that creative voice, he says, is really about the individual expressing their own personal version of the society's ills. And that a society hears that or they don't hear that. So he puts the growth of civilization at the hands of the artist. It's a beautiful work. And it's serious scholarship. You know, it's, as I said, I think there's 13 volumes. So, again, it's a little bit of a detour, but I think Pauli's doing the same thing and why this work is so important. We're not just talking about him, although he's interesting in himself, but we're looking at our time. And we're looking about what needs to happen in our time and why I think it's worth all this effort. Okay. Page 228. Have we done two pages so far? Let's go down to where it says 41, because that diagram, it will come up in a minute. So Kepler could thus remove both the devil and the world soul from the universe. See where I am? Where it says bracket 41. That's the page in the German. 41. Kepler could thus remove both the devil and the Platonic world soul from the universe. Now, this is what we just said. That to Kepler, the cosmos was reduced to a gigantic machine whose predictable mathematical laws, there are the three big words, predictable mathematical laws, he was able to formulate. He was able to begin formulating. Predictable mathematical laws were evidence of the regularity of God. His work became inspiration for Newton, who really set science on its own feet. Now, in contrast, Kepler began to attack the worldview of the alchemist and Dr. Robert Fludd. Kepler, I think, was Kepler, you know, Tom, was he Dutch or?
I thought he was Dutch. I think he was Deutsch.
He might be Dutch. I'll check that. Or I think he was Scandinavian of some sort. Fludd, I believe, was English, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Thus began an intense polemic between Kepler and Fludd. As Pauli emphasizes in his 1952 essay on Kepler, this is the work where he compared these two guys' work. Fludd was not able to understand Kepler's world of ideas. For Fludd, now we're looking at the medieval standpoint, in contrast. The Earth stood in the center of the universe. This is the way Fludd was able to postulate an interpenetration of two principles, form as the light principle, which comes from God, and matter, which resides in the earth as a dark principle. If you go back to your illustrations, it's figure 3.1. Small, but that triangle, that's God. That's the Holy Trinity. And it, so to speak, emanates a force field to the earth. And the earth, in turn, emanates a force field back to the Trinity. And at the crosshairs of those two is the sun. So the sun, remember we're talking about the medieval mind. The sun, he's not talking about mathematical laws, he's talking about mysteries of creation. And the sun is created out of the mystery of the form of God meeting the matter of the earth. And he was happy with that. That's what he said explained the existence of things, while Kepler was saying it was the mathematical regularity which explained the existence of things. It's a collision between two utterly different eons. Why is that so important? I think we are at such a collision between eons right now, where the world that Kepler has laid out, so to speak, is starting to fall apart. And so we're going to be turning back to that other world, just like at that time, one eon gave birth to another. The old one now is going to be the parent, perhaps, or some dimensions of the other one for the new one.
I'm looking at the correlation between that first figure and that on the board.
Yeah.
I mean, it just... Fix.
Oh, that is what I put on the board. Isn't it?
No. No, this is an atom.
Oh, atom, yes.
An electron, but it's still, I mean, that area that's not named is that place.
Of course, now we know that's a very incomplete picture, mm-hmm. because that atom is, we don't know, is that atom a particle or is it a wave? So it does be, it, there are some similarities, but it also begins to fall apart. And where here we can predict, here we can't predict where that atom is. So the certainty of Kepler is being called into question. And I think, likewise, we are seeing through Jung's work, the absence of the world soul from the side of psychology is also beginning to be challenged. We can't define it in the medieval way, but we cannot give up our acknowledgement and our experience of that fact. That is a fact science must begin at some point in its career to take account of. And Pauli knew that. The other point here is that for Flood, the existence of God is to be seen in the miracle of that sun's creation when the form of God and the form and the material of the earth intersect. So for Kepler, the miracle of God is to be seen in the regularity of events. And for Kepler, for Flood, it's to be seen in the continual creation within the universe. We see that leaves room for synchronicity if there's a continual creation. And if the universe is a mystery that is being created.
And that's Flood.
That's Flood. As the author says there at the bottom of 28, Flood is fascinated by the ancient transformation mystery. The infant son is born. And naturally, Kepler's new astronomical discoveries contribute little to a better understanding of this mystery. Well, it's this darn mystery we're faced with every time somebody has a synchronistic experience. So we can't just get rid of it anymore. How are you doing?
My brain hurts.
Your brain hurts? Should we have some brain chewing gum? I'm about ready to go back to the dream now. All these motifs are contained in Pauli's dreams. Dream. The Inquisition has the meaning of that which defends an old worldview. The one taken as truth by Christianity at the time.
What are you reading?
29, the first full paragraph. Now, what's so hard about this dream is that it doesn't have one clear meaning. Because we've seen there is something to be defended about the pre-scientific worldview. And yet there's also something true in the emergence of the mandala in the fascination of science with the rotation of the planets.
So then also the Kepler viewpoint needs to be defended.
Right.
Is that one just one word typographically?
Yeah, probably. Which one?
It says where who stand in contrast to.
Contrast. Yeah. Where is that?
It's the fifth line down at the end.
Yeah, contrast, yeah. The judge, should be judges, are incapable of understanding what motivates the supporters of the Copernican system who stand in contrast to the old. That, to me, is the main message of the dream. The judges resent the emergence of the self. First experienced in fascination with orbits. The blonde alone knows that they are fascinated by a mandala motif, that, however, they find only outwardly in the movements of the planets about the sun. Their wives, the anima, have objectified the rotation. In other words, made that projection.
Why does he say it as objectified the rotation?
That's his way of speaking, and I think what he means is that it's really a subjective process which they are experiencing in projection objectively. Well, you can see if now remember these judges we have to take on two levels as both a statement about the evolution of science and about Pauli's own personal development. Let's go with Pauli's own personal development. The judge in him hates the self. And if they're upset by the experience of the self in projection, imagine the squawk they're going to make when he tries to withdraw that projection. He's being sent to jail or in an environment of those being sent to jail simply for accepting there is such a thing as rotation. So you can see that battle he's going to have to come to selfhood. So the collective voice in him does not want him to be an individual. And, you know, from common sense, you could say, why should it? He's going to get the Nobel Prize. Why speak a message that will only subject him to ridicule when he's at the top of the heap? Remember, Einstein said, you're my successor.
Where would the ego fit in this?
Pauli, in the dream. The other dimension of the meaning is that with respect to Pauli, is that the anima is not known. But the anima is at the basis of all this. And that's why he's a Don Juan. So that's, I think, the basic motive, basic meaning with respect to Pauli. And with respect to science, I think the Inquisition would represent those forces that don't want science to evolve. They want to keep it a safe process that doesn't have to come to terms with the mystery of life. And Pauli was terribly conflicted because he knew from his own personal life synchronicity was a reality. And he was enough of a scientist to know that the business of science is to investigate facts. And here was a fact that science couldn't come to grips with. And he was being addressed to express that publicly. That reference. Do you all know the secret of the golden flower? Anyone who doesn't know the secret of the golden flower? You can pass this. If you don't know, I'll just pass it around. It's a Chinese text with they're spread throughout the essay. Four pictures. One a guy meditating. I'll pass it around. And then out of the diamond that he's meditating on, a figure emerges. And then that figure splits. And that's where the text stops. Sorry, that's where the picture stops. But the text goes on. These woodcuts have been lost, the rest of them. The text goes on to say, when these things come together, a golden flower is produced. That's why it's called the text of the golden flower. And it was given to Jung in 1928 by a missionary from China, a German missionary from China. And Jung felt it was confirmation of his research into the nature of the self. Because the self starts out as a unity, splits, it comes back together in an image of value, either a diamond or a golden flower or something. But the text says you get all of this going by circulating the light. And by that, Jung interpreted it to mean meditation. Not, you know, Buddhist meditation for us, but taking our energy and circulating around our various complexes as we get to know ourselves in analysis. So that's what Pali then it thinks of when they refer to the circulation of the light. That would be the inner meaning of the mandala, where you take your attention and you examine your totality for the purpose of finding your center. And somewhere here, I'll pass it around if you don't know it.
Okay.
Is that okay? I think we've gone basically over to page 30.
I can explain what is the meaning of the send another note to the wife and then the wife eventually.
That he's got to begin to recognize his own anima involvement here. Emotional and feeling. And that's why at the end when he cries, the blonde man says, now you have the first key. That this is not merely Wolfgang in an objective process. You need to see the motif of rotation in you personally, how you resist it, and also understand how that whole theme has affected the science that you participate in.
How does that get affected as the anima? As the anima.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You're saying the key is the... What's the key?
When he cries.
That
would be an emotion. And the anima would stand for his emotional life. So by the end of the dream, he begins to feel personally what's going on. Does that make sense? I don't think Pali was a guy who cried much. He was too busy telling other people how to live.
The other question is, why did he, in the beginning of the dream, the Negroes pull out all possible purpose that could carry that message?
I think the Europeans project their instinctual side onto the black races. And that was another aspect of the emotional side. I think we do it here too, but also in Europe, because there, Negro means African. But it's the same here. I don't know what blacks project on us necessarily, but that's what we project on the blacks. You know, more instinctual, more sexual, more body-oriented. And that's exactly what he needed to develop. That's why the woman in the earlier dream was the dark woman. But that aspect of the anima dealing with relationship and the body aspect of relationship, which was so problematic for him. As I said, I think he had a friendship with his wife, but not a passionate connection. Well, we have just a couple of minutes. Do you want to just rehash before we...
Question.
Yeah.
You said that the judge is how he takes himself. Are you saying he's unconscious?
Yes, an unconsciousness. Unconscious hatred, sure.
Why would you use hate?
Well, because they kill people.
And you're saying himself is his big death, and that's his.
I think it's both. I mean, as we're working with this societally, there's a personal self and there's a collective self. And they're just two different dimensions of the same thing. But what the collective self is doing, it's trying to move us forward into higher levels of consciousness, or if you don't like that word, into being able to understand what, how we are to develop and what the times are asking of us, how we can develop culturally and mentally and psychologically as a species. So when the Inquisition is attacking knowledge, which is simply true, that's hatred of the self. That's a hatred of those forces that want to deal with reality and live on. And you find that in individuals, too, who are very, very conformist. When an individual reaction comes up, either in them or anyone around them, they'll shoot them down.
I think you looked something inside me when you said that, Jim, because for me, hate is an emotion. And when I think of my judge, it's like cold intellect. And so, to me...
Yeah, but that's the same thing.
The emotion hate is and the cold intellect?
Yeah, think of those pictures of the Germans shooting the Jews. Just bored to death. That's hate.
Okay, my hate is more a passionate emotion.
Well, you said it was cold.
No, I said that's the judge. That's why I was saying two differences. The difference between the two. To me, judge can be cold intellect and... somehow hate's more passionate.
Oh.
That's what, when you said that, why did you say hate?
Well, that leaves out the whole phenomenon of passive-aggressive.
I can see where they come together, but that's why it did stop me. And that may just be my own thoughts about what judging is.
Yeah, because, I mean, one of the young statement was the person who, or somebody, they said that the person who hates God will know him sooner than the person. I don't remember where that came from, but something like that.
The kid that hated his dad so much he became just like
him.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of softens the outlook of the judges by saying the judges do not know what rotation or revolution is, and that is why they cannot understand the men. So, it's saying they're lacking some understanding as to why they're judging the way they are.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
And that's the intellect to me, rather than...
Yeah.
I can see the two tied together.
Yeah, but I wouldn't limit it to intellect.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see the connection, but I also, in my head, I can see the disconnect in the word at the same time. I can see both. Not at the same time.
In any case, they're against it.
I got it. But when you said that took something in me, too.
Oh, where hate usually pushes people's
buttons. But maybe the judge is not just the heavy-handed hierarchy, but the whole of the larger part of humanity.
I think you could, sure.
Do you think the judge in a man is different than a judge in a woman? Well, I was thinking of animals.
Oh, shucks, we're out of time.
Okay, got it.
Never mind.
I mean, anybody really, I mean, the judging that you interact in your life is not just the law or the church, or it is all the people around you that you meet in day to day.
Yeah, here I think it's the law gone astray. It's the law of not serving what it's supposed to serve, which is the truth. Mm-hmm. Well, we did get to page 30.
My figure.
Okay. Looks like we're getting through about 5 or 10 pages. How many did we do today? 6 pages. Did we? No, we did.
We started on page 24.
4 pages, so I think we'll speed up, you know, once we get the basic issues clear.
It's really important to have that.
I think it is.
There's a lot of stuff.
Without it, what's the point of what it's all about?
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard. It is hard. Because I think it is the birth of a new paradigm. Which we just have hints of. And we'll have to put up with anxiety and contradiction because that's the way new things surface. Okay, so see you in 2.
This extra pen flew off the table. It said it wanted an answer.
It did.
Yeah, it did.